volunteering at a Reasons to Believe office, you will not, as someone was asking me, have to work with the criminals. That's during the week, and they're not really criminals. I mean, what we do is we have people that volunteer for us to fulfill their community service requirements that the justice system puts down on them. And it's been a real blessing for us. I mean, these people have really contributed to the ministry. It's been fun to have them volunteering for us during the week. In fact, we've seen some come to Christ, and what's really been a blessing is to have them come back after they finish their community service and to continue to volunteer for us because they have such a good time. We have yet to have a bad experience. And the Justice Service loves it. We're kind of at the top of their list as a place to send people that are getting into trouble and need to fulfill their community service. So, in fact, there was one time there was a guy who was doing graffiti all over Glendora. In fact, our place got graffiti. I don't know whether he was the one that did it or not, but he had a fun time doing community service for us. So that was good. I was going to give you a report on some of the things we've been doing on the mission field. I'm going to dispense with that. Maybe I'll do that next week. But I want to talk to you about a scientific discovery. I want to make sure we got time to make some progress in our study on Job 38. But before I do that, you know, a number of you know that if you go on the web and type my name in a search engine, all you get is negative stuff except the stuff from Reasons to Believe. I mean, it's amazing. All these young earth organizations and atheist organizations that have bad things to say about me. But someone at our office handed me the first. It's the first positive statement about me on the web that doesn't come from Reasons to Believe. And it's right here, and this is what it says. It's hard to believe that Hugh Ross's first bodybuilding competition was in 2002. I'll continue. Excuse me. At the Musclemania Atlantic, stepping on stage for the first time, Hugh entered the men's novice division and easily took the overall title. He also won the men's master title in the over 40 class. Hugh's specialties are paratrooping, jungle warfare, amphibious operations, close quarter combat, and skills in arms. Well, you can read about the whole thing. It's on the web. Just type Hugh Ross into a search engine, and this will pop up if you dig down past all the young earth creationist complaints about me. So never knew I had it in me, no. Well, what you see is my off-season weight, okay? Yeah, it's funny. You know, my parents gave me the name Hugh Norman Ross because they wanted to make sure that no one else would have that name. Hugh being a Welsh name, Norman English, and Ross is Scots. They figured nobody with the name of Ross would want to associate with the Welsh and the English. But if you look in the Toronto phone book, there's about a half dozen Hugh Norman Rosses in the phone book. But I pitied my son Dave. I said to my son David, you cannot go back to Canada. I mean, you go to Canada and live there and look up your name in a Toronto phone book, it runs on about 9 or 10 pages. So, and you know, even his middle name, David Michael Ross, there's a page and a half of David Michael Ross's. So, but you know, I never thought that I'd run into this, Hugh Ross. So, thought I had a unique name until I dug into there. In the latest issue of Science, I just got this 2 days ago. There's an interesting review. And it's done by Alessandro Morbidelli. That's his real name. I can't imagine having a name Morbidelli, but that's the way it is. And he's probably the premier researcher on the dynamics of the outer solar system. And in this review, it's hardly a review because what he's reviewing is 4 research papers that were all published just weeks ago. And there are papers predominantly in the journals Icarus and the Astrophysical Journal. But what he has come up with, I've got a kind of diagram here on the board, and I'm going to go over to the board here, and hopefully you all will be able to hear me.
As what he points out, this is a diagram of the outer solar system where eccentricity goes up this way. If you're not familiar with the term, that refers to the shape of a planetary or an asteroid's orbit. And so our planet Earth has almost circular orbits, but for example, Mercury and Pluto have orbits that are quite elliptical. And so the degree of ellipticity is referred to as the eccentricity. And on this axis, we have distance, and everything's relative to the Sun. So the Sun would be 0, 0, and the eccentricity of Jupiter and Saturn are here, and you can see they're very close to zero, just like planet Earth. And then we have Uranus and Neptune here, but what he plots here is the position and the eccentricity of Uranus and Neptune before they began to interact with what's called the Kuiper-Edgeworth belt of comets and asteroids. And I kind of got this here. This is the belt of the comets and asteroids. There's two peaks here that show up right here, and then suddenly it drops off. Now, what Morbidelli is talking about is the very latest computer simulation on how the early Uranus and the early Neptune would interact with the early Kuiper belt of comets and asteroids. Now, I'll give you the bottom line. The bottom line is that Uranus moves up and Neptune moves out, and then Uranus drops down to an eccentricity of virtually zero, and Neptune really does go down to zero, as virtually a completely circular orbit. And then this Edgeworth Kuiper belt of comets actually moves out as well. And then it diminishes considerably. So today we have Uranus out about here, Neptune is out about here, and then the Edgeworth Kuiper belt today runs from about here out to about a distance here, maybe a peak here, and there's a peak right here, and then it stays up about here, with a much smaller population. The other thing that's coming out of these studies is that the interaction, the initial interaction between Uranus and Neptune and the Edgeworth Kuiper belt, for some reason, is delayed about 700 million years. So there's something that happened in the solar system, maybe a star came by or whatever, that began to initiate this interaction between the asteroids in Uranus and Neptune and cause everything to move up. At the same time, this interaction resulted in what's called a late heavy bombardment of comets and asteroids on the inner solar system. So for example, when you look up at the moon tonight, you'll get a really good view of the moon if you stay up late enough tonight. You'll see that it has these big basins and it's filled with craters if you look at it through a pair of binoculars. Both the basins and the craters were caused by the late heavy bombardment. Giant asteroids pelted the moon with such force that it actually liquefied large portions of the moon's surface that it created what looks like lava beds. They're just simply the result of melt flow from these giant asteroids. But when we look at what happened to planet Earth, it would have liquefied the Earth from the surface down at least 300 kilometers, maybe even as much as 1,000 kilometers, and would have made even the surface temperature of the Earth 3,000 degrees centigrade. And this happened 3.85 billion years ago. It took 50 million years for that event to subside, where a crust was formed and oceans were formed. And we note that carbon 12 to carbon 13 ratio put the origin of life at 3.80 billion years ago. As we write about in our Origins of Life book, the late heavy bombardment gives us our strongest proof that the origin of life happened instantaneously. I mean, you can take 3.85, subtract 50 million, you get 3.80, and 3.80 is when you see the first evidence for life on the planet Earth. Now, the timing of the late heavy bombardment actually determines whether or not you're going to get advanced life on planet Earth. If the late heavy bombardment happens too early or too late, then you miss the opportunity for Earth to sustain advanced life. I mean, this period of time, 3.8 billion years between the first life and advanced life is critical, and the beginning of when you start that late heavy bombardment is also critical. And what's critical for advanced life on planet Earth is that all the gas giants have virtually zero eccentricity. If Neptune and Uranus remained with a highly eccentric orbit, that would have led to resonances which would have disturbed the orbits of the inner solar system's planets and pushed Earth in and out of the life support zone. So it was really critical that Uranus and Neptune's high eccentricity be driven down to zero. It's also critical that they be pushed out much farther than where they began. If they were not forced out by their interaction with the Edwards-Kuiper belt, then that too would have set up destructive resonances which would have pulled Earth, Mars, and Venus and Mercury out of their orbital positions, and Earth would have been pushed in and out of the life support zone. I mean, as I read this paper, what I was able to come up with were 8 separate design parameters that flow out of this very latest detailed computer modeling of what happened here. It's also critical that this Edwards belt of comets, Edwards-Kuiper belt, got considerably diminished. You say, how much was it diminished by? By about a factor of 100. The Edwards belt, Kuiper belt of comets and asteroids today has a population only 1% of what it started out with, and also it's been pushed out from the orbit of Neptune to about 1.5 billion miles past the orbit of Neptune. And actually what results in the sharp cutoff here is the fact that there's a remnant that's set up between Neptune and the Edwards-Kuiper belt of comets and asteroids, and the final resonance results in an actual boundary. There are no Kuiper objects beyond it. There were cloud objects way out here, but there's no Kuiper belt objects beyond this point. And this too, the borders of the Edwards-Kuiper belt and the population of the Edwards-Kuiper belt must be fine-tuned to make as advanced life as possible on planet Earth. Yes.
There are two pieces of this that seem counterintuitive. It's a simple answer, maybe you can give it to me now, otherwise I'll have to go look at the paper. One is the usual thought that we started out as this big collective disk would seem opposite to the idea that Uranus and Neptune initially had high eccentricity. And the other is that typically when you have systems like this, like the dust that's given off in say Saturn's ring, it's generally thought to gradually degrade in orbit and come into the parent body. You've got everything moving out away from the sun.
Okay. Those are good points, because as we've been looking at gas giant planets that are orbiting other stars, what we're seeing without exception is these gas giants drift in. And they drift in until the debris is cleaned out of that stellar system. What we're seeing here are two planets, gas giants, that are drifting out rather than drifting in. Okay. When you work out the computer modeling in detail, what you discover is that you do indeed would have these gas giants drifting in when there's lots of dust and small debris that's within the stellar system. And indeed, there is some evidence that Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune did drift in a little bit. Now, this would have happened when the solar system was very young. What we're talking about is a drift mechanism that kicks in when the solar system is about 600 to 700 million years old. So the initial drift happens when the solar system is less than 5 million years old. So in the first 5 million years, there's copious amounts of dust in the solar system. Only millions. Yeah. I mean, when we look at extrasolar planets, the dynamics is pretty well done in about 5 million years. Some cases you can go up to 10 million.
So the whole thing, the sun starts about 5 billion years ago.
Right.
And there's this long time period before all this happened.
Right.
And so things are pretty much settled down and we have planets and everything. And now we're just talking about millions of years.
Right. What's happening in the first few million years is that you're getting this flattened disk, and rather than looking at lots of planetesimals, you do have planetesimals in great abundance, and by planetesimals, we're talking about stuff that's quite big. Objects that are, let's say, bigger than Ganymede, the moon, and all the way up to the size of Pluto, and even higher. I mean, there'll be planets like Mercury and Mars whizzing around in chaotic orbits. But that stuff gets cleaned out fairly quickly. and the dust gets cleaned out fairly quickly. I mean, you know, today our solar system has virtually no dust in it. But in the first 5 million years, it was very dusty. And as we look at young stellar objects, stars that are forming, that are relatively small mass, we see that they're enshrouded in this big, thick, dusty disk. But that dusty disk will only persist for a few million years, then it gets cleaned out. No, only hundreds of millions of years, not billions of years. This is an event that Morbidelli believes occurred when the solar system was about 600 or 700 million years old. And so to complete this scenario, in the first few million years, you've got inward drift. But one thing that's special about our solar system, it got very little inward drift. And it got very little inward drift because the dust got cleaned out quite quickly. And the belief is that our solar system formed in a star cluster where there were supergiant stars that sent out a strong stellar wind that basically cleaned everything out rather quickly. And because it cleaned things out quickly, we have very little drift of the gas giants. They drifted some, but not anything like what we see in these extrasolar systems. Because we would have formed next to these supernovae. Well, the other thing that you have to fine-tune is you've got to kick the solar system quickly away from the star cluster. And that is something special about our solar system, is that unlike other stars that have planets around them, we left our birthing cluster really quickly. And what that did is it preserved the orbits from getting highly eccentric. So that's one of the things that we notice is special about our solar system, is that as the planets have very low eccentricities, whereas everything else we observe is very high eccentricities. Right. I mean, the only eccentric planets we have today are Pluto and Mercury, and they're tiny. I mean, we would expect them to have high eccentricities because they're the ones that are most subject to these destructive resonances, which build these eccentricities. But everything else has a circular orbit. However, what Morbidelli and his team are pointing out is that was not the case with Uranus and Neptune. Not being as massive as Jupiter and Saturn, they would have been more subject to the resonance set up by Jupiter and Saturn, which would have pushed their eccentricities up. But now they say this is the means by which their eccentricities were reduced to zero. No, this phenomena is something that probably, and you know, they're still working all this stuff out. But what they're concluding is that this outward drift of Uranus and Neptune took place rather late in the solar system's history, 600 or 700 million years after the solar system formed, whereas the early inward drift took place in the first few million years. And the early inward drift was quite limited. It pushed Jupiter and Saturn in just a little bit, not much at all. And so in the last 600 or 700 million years this takes place. Yeah, but everything, I mean, the amazing thing is how many things have to occur in the history of the solar system to get everything just right so advanced life would be possible here on planet Earth. And I know until a few weeks ago, none of these papers were published, and we weren't even aware of this exotic design that we're now becoming. Yes?
You've been collecting this design evidence for a long time now, and you just glean it out of the scientific literature. It's not hidden.
No, I'm not the only one that notices this. I'm probably the one, however, who is engaged in trying to be fairly exhaustive in collecting it. I mean, if you pick up the DVD, Privileged Planet, they talk about 20 design characteristics that we see in the solar system. And most textbooks that I pick up on the properties of the solar system, that's about what they'll acknowledge, maybe 20, but it's always 20 different ones. That's what I find interesting. You pick up one book, they'll acknowledge 20. Pick up another, and they'll acknowledge, you know, say 15 or 20, but they're quite different. You put the two together, you got, 35. And then you get another textbook, and they'll mention maybe a dozen characteristics, but 8 of them will be unique to that book. I mean, that's one way we've collected our list. We just go through other people's published stuff on design, and say, well, you know, let's just put it all together and see what we come up with. But in addition to that, we read journals like Science and Icarus and Astrophysical Journal, and we pick up stuff that the authors don't acknowledge as design. I mean, you can read this four-page paper. There's not one word in the paper that talks about how any of these characteristics have to be fine-tuned for advanced light. The word design never shows up, and so you kind of got to be looking for it. I mean, here is Morbidelli completely. I mean, he's published probably 40 papers on the dynamics of the solar system that must be fine-tuned for light to be possible. He never uses the word fine-tuning, never uses the word design, never makes a connection about these characteristics and how they pertain to light, either primitive or advanced. That shows up in none of this stuff. But it's one of the richest troves I've been able to find, his research papers for digging up evidences for supernatural design.
So any of them try to have a secular explanation for it? Anyone attempted it?
Well, I mean, what Morbidelli is talking about here is just how amazing this all is, that our solar system has these unique characteristics, and you know how we have to have these exotic events taking place to explain the fact that Uranus and Neptune have so low eccentricity orbits and are far enough out. I think I've mentioned here in the class before that the distance that Jupiter is from the Sun, and for Saturn, and for Neptune, and for Uranus, have to be fine-tuned to better than a percent, or you're not going to have Earth orbiting about the Sun in an orbit that will keep it in a life support zone. So the precise distance of the four gas giants, the masses of the four gas giants, their eccentricities and their inclinations all have to be exquisitely fine-tuned, or advanced life's not going to be possible here on planet Earth. But the people doing the research never word it that way. They simply make the comment, you know, isn't it unusual that these four gas giants all have virtually zero eccentricity and zero inclination? And no other planetary system do we see that happening. How unusual. That's about as close as they come to acknowledging that there's something designed about this. Yes?
Is it possible that they actually recognize that it's a miracle and it's God's hand, but that's like a kiss of death if you want to be printed in the
I wouldn't give them that much credit for their theological acuity. I mean, it's possible that some of them are thinking like that, and particularly you talk about the cosmic design characteristics, you do have astronomers who will admit that they're under pressure to deny the theological implications. I mean, you've got people like the chairman of the astronomy department at UC San Diego, Jeffrey Burbidge, who says, yes, I know all this stuff points to God, that's why I refuse to accept that this is really valid astronomy. So, yeah, I mean, but he's unusual. Most of them just say, you know, this is fascinating science. That's as far as they get.
He'd make a good young Earther.
Well, I mean, that's something I've noticed, is that in terms of the psychological workings, atheists and younger creationists seem to be cut from the same mold of trying to deny what's obviously there in the record because they don't like the theological implications, even though the theological implications they're reacting to are very different. So, I mean, both groups deny the Big Bang, and both groups are running away from this design evidence. So, there's a question here. Well, this kind of material won't even be in the undergraduate college level text. But what you will find in high school physics books, for example, I mean, they are up to date enough where they're acknowledging that astronomers have found planets outside the solar system. So that's already made it down to the high school level. However, what you get is some commentary that this establishes that planets are common in the universe, and therefore that we need to be open to the possibility that intelligent life may be quite abundant in our galaxy and the universe in particular, or the universe in our galaxy in particular. So I've seen that in high school textbooks, which is disturbing because, you know, they need to make some acknowledgement about the fact, yeah, we are finding planets outside the solar system, but none of these planets that we're finding would be conducive to the support of even primitive life.
Do you think that that might be because in a public school system as opposed to a private school system, a public school system has to separate, you know, the separation of the church and state and separation of God and the system of divine creation?
To some degree, I think that's going on. I mean, some of our class members are with Wes right now studying Romans 1 through 8. What do you see in Romans 1? It tells us that the propensity of all human beings is to deny the truth that the record of nature reveals about God. So we have to expect that that's going to show up in the textbooks. That's something that's common to all human beings. But something else that we see in the book of Romans, chapter 7, is that the law of the mind agrees with the law of God. In other words, even though that we are fallen before God, as we heard in the worship service this morning, our mind is capable of discerning truth, and therefore there's nothing really wrong with our mind in its capacity to discern truth in the record of nature, but it's the sin within us that causes us to refuse to acknowledge that what we see in the record of nature is telling us things about the existence of God and his personal attributes. Therefore, we shouldn't be shocked that we have high school textbooks that sidestep that part of the science. I mean, you pick up a... In fact, one proof I would give for that model of interpretation of the book of Romans, you pick up a science textbook in the public education arena, and the science is typically really faithful until it gets to those points that point directly to the attributes of God, and then you see the distortion. Now, it's not just the high school textbooks that do that. I mean, I would even credit this article here. Here's this guy, Morbidelli, you know, acknowledging this incredible revelation coming about our study of the outer solar system. But he's not making the links to the God of the Bible. I mean, they look real obvious to me, and he's just saying, ignoring them. Now, there's nothing in the article here that distorts the truth about the record of nature. So I think that's Romans 7. The law of the mind agrees with the law of God. There's no perversion here of what the science is revealing. What's lacking, however, is the interpretive step about what this tells us about the existence and the character of God. That part's missing. And yeah, it does show up in the textbooks as well. By the way, I don't think the separation of church and state is a problem for us. In fact, I think it's an asset. It's an asset in this way. If you look at the 1981 Supreme Court ruling on the teaching of creationism in public schools, they ruled against it primarily because they could not find any expert scientific witnesses that would testify to the integrity and the reliability of the science behind the creationism curriculum. And because they couldn't find any integrity or credibility in the science content of the creationist model, they said, we have to judge it on its religious merits. And judging on its religious merits, they brought forward a number of theologians and pastors from leading denominations who testified that this is a position held by one segment within the evangelical Christian community. And therefore, the Supreme Court justices said this violates the separation of church and state, clause in the Constitution. You know, the government is not to be involved in establishing one denomination against other denominations. It shouldn't establish it, and it shouldn't discourage the practice of religion either. And on that basis, I would agree with the Supreme Court justices. Because there was no scientific merit in the creationist case, they had to try it on religious grounds, and on religious grounds, there was a clear violation of the Establishment Clause. On the other hand, one thing that Supreme Court justices said that I think strongly goes in our favor is they said if the creationists had come in with a model that had established integrity scientific and integrity and credibility. It's in regardless of its theological implications. Remember, they said in their ruling, it doesn't matter what the theological implications are, providing the model has acknowledged scientific integrity and credibility. And they went one step further. They said, we're not saying that it has to have perfect integrity or perfect credibility. It just has to have some level of established credibility and integrity. And if you read the testimonies that were brought in, they had scientists who were Christians come in and scientists who were not Christians come in. And in terms of those who were not younger creationists, not one of them, Christian or non-Christian, would testify that they could find any scientific integrity or credibility to their model. In other words, they all said it was zero. Now, if it's got zero integrity and zero credibility, how can the Supreme Court justices rule that this is okay to teach in the public education arena? I mean, it really would be equivalent to mandating that our public schools would have to give equal time for those who believe that the world is flat. I mean, are we going to do that? No, we've been ruling against that since the nation was conceived. So in that case, something like this, we have every right to bring to the public. I mean, this is stuff that's been acknowledged by the scientific community as having integrity and credibility. We can bring it in regardless of its theological implications. So any of you that are teachers out there, you can go into your public education classrooms and you can present this stuff with the Supreme Court backing you up completely in spite of its theological implications, its implications that Christianity really is a trustworthy faith. Yes.
I remember being, I spent 5 years as a mathematics teacher, and I remember the quality of mathematics textbooks was generally somewhere between poor and worse, and the science textbooks are anywhere close to that. That's a different setting. Yeah, they're generally poor to present a scientific subject, and even engage in scientific thought in their students. But my question here is, I'm noticing that in this model, planets are moving outward from the sun, and that to me suggests an increase in energy. And I'm wondering what's the force that's pulling Uranus and Neptune out. And I guess a follow-up question would be, how come it's not pulling Jupiter and Saturn and the rest of the minor planets out as well?
Okay. This is still research that is developing. you know, I've read the papers that this guy's referring. He mentions nothing about the movement of Jupiter and Saturn after the first 10 million years. But having read the papers he refers to, there is the possibility that Jupiter and Saturn also experienced a slight outward drift. In fact, there are some astronomers who believe that the inward drift that Jupiter and Saturn experienced in the first 5 million years was compensated by an outward drift when they began to interact with this Edgeworth belt of asteroids and comets. However, the outward drift would be much, much smaller than what you would get from Uranus and Neptune. Why? Because you can see there in the diagram, the primordial solar system has Uranus and Neptune embedded in the Edgeworth belt of asteroids. Jupiter and Saturn would not be embedded. And therefore, the gravitational effect on Jupiter and Saturn would be minuscule compared to Neptune and Uranus. On the other hand, there could be some interaction which would have pulled Jupiter and Saturn slightly outward. It's going to take better models to determine whether or not that's a factor. But if you wanted my guess on it, my guess would be is that it would be a small factor. I mean, you know, they're still close enough to the Kuiper belt of asteroids that they should get some interactive pull that would cause them to move outward a little bit, but nothing like what you would get for Uranus and Neptune.
Size
well, I mean, on that diagram there,
yeah.
You wouldn't be able to, it'd be just a very short arrow of movement outward. Neptune gets pulled out the most. Uranus, almost as much. Jupiter and Saturn, hardly at all, would be my best guess on what's going to happen. And in terms of the inner solar system bodies, they would be completely unaffected by this. So, now we get impacted by the asteroids that are between Jupiter and Mars. They have an impact on us. So, in answer to a question earlier, that would also have a factor on the pulling Uranus or Jupiter and Saturn in a little bit. So, it really depends where all this stuff is. So where the planetesimals are and the sizes that they manifest are all important.
I'm assuming that these are based on kind of mathematical model type of things, or how do we get from where it is now to this?
Well, this would be a wonderful problem that you would give to undergraduate students that are taking what's called classical mechanics. And by the way, if you go back about a couple of hundred years in Britain, every university student, didn't matter whether you're in the arts, the sciences, engineering, didn't matter, everybody was required to take a fairly advanced course in classical mechanics, just because they thought to be educated you needed this, just like you needed a good course in Greek and Latin. But today hardly anybody takes a class in classical mechanics. But one of the things you learn in classical mechanics is if you can determine with high precision the positions and the masses and the orbital characteristics of all the bodies that are interacting with one another, and you can work out a model, a mathematical model, that will tell you where they were and the properties they had in the past and where they will be in the future. I mean, I remember one problem we would assign to students was to look at the orbit of Venus. You know, Venus is something we can measure with high precision, its mass, its position, its orbit, and we can look at how it interacts with the Sun and with Earth, and you just kind of crank the handle on your Hamiltonians, and you can figure out where Venus was in the past. And we just did this as a fun exercise so our students could demonstrate that Emanuel Velikovsky was completely out to lunch when he claimed that Venus was a comet that became a planet. All you got to do is crank these equations. You don't have to do them even very accurately, and you can show that's bogus fairly straightforwardly. In fact, if you do it with high precision, we know with very high precision exactly where Venus has been for the past quarter billion years. So, and also the Earth. But, you know, here we've got, because what's made this possible is that we've now discovered thousands of Kuiper Belt objects. And we determine where the limit is. And that's kind of the main thing in these new papers, is we now have accurate measurements on where the last Kuiper Belt objects come. And what they discovered, it's a rather sharp boundary. And it's a boundary that's determined by what's called the 1-2 resonance with Neptune. So, you know, here's Neptune making an orbit around the Sun. You get this boundary of Kuiper Belt objects with those objects that have an orbit that takes twice as long to go around the Sun as Neptune does. And that sets up a resonance which forms this boundary. And so using that measurement of that boundary and looking at the orbits of these Kuiper Belt objects and the orbits of Uranus, Neptune, Jupiter, and Saturn, and you know, cranking through the Hamiltonians with a supercomputer, you can trace things back 4 billion years and see what's going on. Now, it can't be done with great precision. I mean, the thing that's still not well determined here is, does this really establish the date for the late heavy bombardment? The evidence suggests that it really does. But we need better models before we can nail that down, and better models will depend on more accurate measurements of more Kuiper Belt objects. So if we can discover 5 or 10,000 more Kuiper Belt objects and measure their orbits, we're in business. So that's why we need NASA to JPL to give us all this new information. But, you know, I'm excited because it gives us design that points to the God of the Bible like we haven't had before. Okay, can we jump to Job 38? All right, let's do that. You've heard me say this before. Job 38, the Lord poses 59-plus science questions to Job, Elihu, Zophar, Eliphaz, and Bildad. That's the five scientists that are having the debate in the first 37 chapters of the book of Job. I won't go through the debate. We've done that already. These men lived about 3,500 to 4,000 years ago, and these five scientists living in that time were unable to answer a single question that God had posed to them in Job 38. By the way, unless you get... I don't want you to be confused on this point. This is only part one of the science tests that God gives to these five ancient scientists. Part two, part three, part four are coming in the next three chapters. So it's just part one, and the part one focuses on the easy questions. The questions get progressively harder. So these are the easy questions. You know, that's kind of how we like to design tests for undergraduate students. You give them a three-hour test, but you really want to encourage them not to walk out of the exam room. So you try to put easy questions up at the front, make them progressively harder and harder, and that will tell you who the really good students are, but you don't want to blow them out of the box with the first few questions. So, well, I think that's a good way to design tests, personally, because there are those that don't. And what happens is the students panic. And when they panic, they all do badly, including the good students. So, you know, I've learned as a professor, you do not want to panic the students by the way you design the test, because otherwise you have to grade on a curve where, you know, the guy who gets an A is the guy who got 20% of the questions. It's not a good way to go. So I always like to start off with a bunch of easy questions, and I see here in the book of Job, God does the same thing. So notice that these 59-plus questions are all only dealing with the physical part of creation. Chapter 39 will deal with the soulish part of creation, but the physical part's the easy part. Okay, and then the question we've been posing for the past few weeks, how many questions should we be able to answer today? Well, if we had not fallen into sin, and if we had fully carried out God's command in Genesis 1:28, the command to manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life, you might come up with a different number. What I came up with is that we would be able to answer about 45 of the 59 plus questions. You know, if we hadn't sinned in the Garden of Eden and you know, had really carried out God's command, by, you know, 3,500 plus years, we should be able to answer 45 of the questions. So I would say sin prevents us from answering about 35 of the questions. Today we can answer 9 questions, but sin stops us from answering 35 of the questions. Our space-time limitations stop us from answering 15 of the questions. So there's 15 questions in this list that no one's going to be able to answer as long as they're confined to the space-time realm of the universe. So you're not going to get a perfect score on this no matter what. So, and then all 9 questions that we can answer serve an apologetics purpose. And we've been through 3 of these already. I'm just going to just quickly just state these. Who can shut up the sea behind doors? And, you know, this is talking about God setting up continents and oceans. This confirms a key prediction made in Genesis 1 that is found in no extra biblical creation account. This is unique to the Bible, this claim that the planet started off with nothing but water, and then God transformed it into continents and oceans. And then that's verse 8. And verse 9, it says that God wrapped the oceans in thick darkness with clouds. That again confirms a critical prediction and interpretation of Genesis 1 that's unique to the Bible. So these are 2 things you can go to convince your skeptical friend that this book indeed is the inspired, inerrant Word of God. How to explain the fact that it's unique to the Bible, and the Bible predicted future scientific discoveries thousands of years in advance of its time. Number 3, verse 16, have you journeyed to the springs of the sea? And we talked last week about how God's creation of life on Earth is amazingly diverse and pervasive. Deep sea vents offer another falsification of naturalistic evolution. I won't go into the details. It's covered in our book, Origins of Life. We know that life could not originate naturally in the oceans because virtually everything in the oceans, in fact, everything in the oceans must pass through these deep sea vents. And when they pass through, that will destroy any prebiotic chemistry going on. Interesting, because sometimes people talk about, well, there's life at deep sea vents. That proves that life must be able to originate under very hostile conditions. Those hostile conditions actually guarantee that there can't be a naturalistic origin of life. The reason we find life there is because God has supernaturally intervened to create really exotic, extremophile life forms that can exist under those conditions, but they certainly can't originate under those conditions. In fact, the existence of the steam vents tells us that there is no naturalistic pathway for the origin of life. It must be supernatural. Okay, what I'm going to try to cover today is what we see in verse 19, second half of verse 19, where does darkness reside? And this is fascinating to me because a year ago this would not have been on my list. In fact, 3 months ago this would not be on my list. But today I think we can put it on the list. We live in that time when astronomers have actually found the location of the darkness. Now, for several years we've known that darkness is out there, and that darkness indeed is the pervasive component of the universe. Right. But until 3 or 4 months ago, we had no idea about the location of the darkness. Now we know the location of the darkness. Actually, that's a little bit of an overstatement. About a year and a half ago, we learned the location of some of the dark stuff. But what I think is special about today, and why I'm putting this on the list of questions that we can answer, is that we know the location of all the dark stuff now. Not just some of it, but all of it. Okay, so what is this dark stuff? There are three portions of darkness that make up the universe. Okay, the light stuff, the stuff that shines forth with light, is things like stars and galaxies, and the gas that is glowing with light because starlight impinges on it and causes it to absorb light and then irradiate the light that it absorbs. So as you look out at the galaxy, look out at the night sky, you will see gas clouds that glow with light. In fact, you can look in Orion, and in the belt of Orion, you'll see three stars that hang down from the belt. That's called the Sword of Orion. The middle star is actually a giant gas cloud, and it glows with light that's so bright you can see it with the naked eye. And if you look at it with a small pair of binoculars, you'll see that it's got a green color, and probably in a small pair of binoculars, you'll see that it covers about a quarter to a half a moon diameter, depending on the light gathering power of your binoculars. So that's a gas cloud, and there's lots of gas clouds in our galaxy. There's stars and galaxies themselves. As you look far away, you can look at the Andromeda galaxy. That's visible to the naked eye tonight as well. So that's the light, but the light accounts for only 0.5% of the total stuff that makes up the universe. Now, the amount of dark matter in the universe that's like matter we're used to makes up 4% of the stuff of the universe. So the stuff that shines with light, that's 0.5%. The dark ordinary matter is 4%. And then what's called exotic dark matter makes up 23% of the total constituents of the universe. Now, dark ordinary matter would be things like pebbles, rocks, asteroids that are far enough away that they don't reflect enough light that we can see them, or distant planets. Astronomers now speculate that our galaxy probably has a goodly number of dissociated planets. What we mean by dissociated planets are stars that would form and form planets, but as these planets interact with one another, planets would be ejected from that stellar system. And so out there in our galaxy must be a lot of free-running planets, bachelor planets, or orphan planets, they call them. Now, these are planets that have been ejected from their star system and are just running around all by themselves orbiting about our galaxy. We know quite a few of these must exist because every extrasolar planetary system we've discovered has gas giants in it with highly eccentric orbits, very elliptical orbits. And that ellipticity, and particularly the inclination, the tilt of the orbit of these gas giants relative to the stellar system, is such that it will produce ejections of the small planets that form in that system. So we expect that there'll be, but that's part of the dark matter, dark exotic matter. Because if a planet's running around by itself, it's not going to be able to shine with any light. It can't reflect enough light for anybody to see it. So maybe I'm waiting for the next disaster movie to show up, which would be, you know, our solar system bumping into one of these orphan planets that are out there and causing chaos. That's dark ordinary matter. Okay. In addition to that, we have exotic matter. And this is matter made up not of protons, neutrons, and electrons, but made up of things called axions and neutrinos, and then there's a whole host of other hypothesized particles. The only exotic mass particle that has been positively identified is the neutrino. But the axion is on the verge of being acknowledged. I can think of three research papers that have been published where there's a strong suggestion that they have found axions, and these axions actually are much more abundant and make up much more mass than the neutrinos do. But most of you have heard of neutrinos. And neutrinos are these little tiny particles that run all over the universe, and they don't interact well with protons, neutrons, or electrons. So, for example, neutrinos go through the entire planet Earth, and they never bump into anything. They just go right through. In fact, as we're all standing here, neutrinos are flowing through our bodies. Lots of neutrinos are going through your bodies, but they don't do anything to you. They just go right through. They don't hit anything. They don't deflect. They don't interact at all. And we astronomers and physicists refer to these kinds of particles as WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. You want to know something really funny? Is that when astronomers coined the term macho, they decided not to trademark it. But when they came up with WIMP, they decided to trademark that to prevent some General Electric company from using that name and putting it on one of their products. I think, you know, why don't you guys trademark macho and forget about trademarking WIMP? I can't imagine any company being so stupid as to put the word WIMP on their on their refrigerator, but I can see them putting the word macho on. So, but for all those of you who want to start a business, macho is up for grabs. You can take that, but you cannot use the word WIMP. So, yes.
What would it take for it to interact? Would it take a direct collision with the center of the atom?
That's what it takes. And so neutrinos do interact on occasion, but it has to be a virtually head-on collision with the nucleus before there's an interaction, and it's got to be a head-on collision with a certain kind of nucleus. And it doesn't interact well with all atoms. And so that's what physicists do, is they build these gigantic collectors that are very dense in terms of their mass, and you know, kind of use the Earth as a device to slow down these neutrinos a little bit. So some of them are actually pointed at the interior of the Earth, using the entire 8,000-mile diameter of the Earth as kind of a buffering device, so that the weak interactions that do take place will slow it down enough that they can pick it up with these exotic detectors, these huge, massive detectors. And what they're really doing is they're pulling out the 1 in a billion neutrinos that do interact. So, I mean, for example, when that supernova erupted in the Large Magellanic Cloud back in 1987, I think it was, it produced an enormous blast of neutrinos at the moment that that supernova was erupted. These detectors scattered all over the world accumulated a total of 9 neutrinos. Now, there were literally trillions of neutrinos that were impacting these detectors, but only 9 were detectable. That's what they mean by weakly interacting massive particles. Their interaction is so weak that you wouldn't notice it unless you were really very diligent in trying to pick up the few that will interact. Okay, but what's new is that astronomers have now determined where this stuff resides. I mean, you know, 5 months ago, I would have to tell you, we know it's out there, because we can make measurements to determine, like the W map, that the universe is 23% exotic dark matter. But we had no idea where it resides. And there was all kinds of speculation. Maybe it's around black holes, maybe it's in the center of our galaxy, but we now have determined what that location is, and we actually determine how much exists in those locations. I'm going to go back to the blackboard and diagram for you where this exotic dark matter resides.
23% of the total stuff that makes up the universe. So the thing that we're all used to, ordinary matter, only makes 4.5%. 23% is exotic stuff. Okay, this is our Milky Way galaxy. The spiral arms that come out like this. The exotic dark matter resides, let me just erase this. The of dark matter resides in a huge halo that's way beyond the visible galaxy. And it's like a huge donut. So it's not a sphere that envelops the galaxy. Rather, you can think of it as a donut. So let me just use this little point. I'll let you this stuff later.
Okay.
But so let's say this is our spiral galaxy. The exotic dark matter would be the gigantic donut that resides in the plane of the galaxy. If you find the plane of the galaxy, you may see this huge donut. And the donut size would be about 6 to 12 times greater than the diameter of the galaxy. So our galaxy is about 120,000 light years across. The diameter of the donut would be about a million light years across. So you can have that back.
Yeah, that's kind of a good analogy for a galaxy, because you've got all that stuff right in the middle. That's the bulge of the galaxy. The plate would be the spiral arms. So thank you, Mary, for setting up that object lesson for me. All right. All we need to know is a gigantic donut to complete it, right? It's all about donuts. What astronomers have done is they've looked at dozens of small and giant galaxies, because the thinking was, well, maybe this is only true of the big galaxies, but we're now finding this is true of all galaxies. Although one thing that's kind of outstanding is, are the shapes of the donuts different for the spherical galaxies as opposed to the flattened disk spiral galaxies? That research is ongoing. But we've gotten far enough where we realize how big these donuts are, where they reside, and it's such that with most galaxy clusters, what you have are the donuts strongly interacting with one another. I mean, if you look at photos of giant clusters of galaxies, you notice how many of the galaxies are interacting with one another, bumping into one another, colliding with one another. Well, this partly explains what's going on here. The donuts actually are overlapping one another. Because in a typical cluster of galaxies, if this is a typical galaxy, the next nearest galaxy would be about here, and then like this would be the size of the ordinary matter that we observe, and therefore the donuts would actually be interacting with one another. And this is giving us a new understanding of the dynamics of what goes on inside of galaxies, but it also means we're seeing another design characteristic. The donuts have got to be just right if you want life existing in the Milky Way galaxy. Yes. Can you? Okay, you can't see the donut because it's dark. I mean, that's the question God asks here. Do you know where darkness resides? Well, it's pretty hard to know where darkness resides because you can't see any light from it. How astronomers are locating the location of the dark stuff as they look for the gravitational interactions. Because even though this stuff does not interact with protons, neutrons, and electrons, just like ordinary matter, it exerts a gravitational force. And so astronomers look for that gravitational force to figure out where this stuff resides, and the big breakthrough has been through gravitational lensing. You know, Einstein's theory of general relativity tells us that if you've got a massive body out there, that massive body will bend light that passes near that body. And so astronomers look for the bending of light and actually look for what they call gravitational lenses. I mean, if you've got...
All right. A couple of object lessons here. What we have here, this little thing, I'll make that the dark matter. Okay. This will be the exotic dark matter. This will be the ordinary matter that's got stars in it. You see light. So this thing is going off some light. But in between this distant object that's glowing with light, we have a blob of exotic dark matter. However, these two blobs of matter line up on a perfectly straight line with the telescope of the observer. And Einstein's theory of general relativity would say that this blob of exotic dark matter will cause the light of the distant object to bend around it. And so the bends around it, when you look at it with a telescope, you're going to see the circle of light around this distant galaxy of this itself. If you look for that circle of light, and the characteristics of that circle of light will tell you how much mass you're looking at, whether the mass that you're observing is exotic or ordinary, and basically the location of it all.
But as you can understand, this only works if you've got hundreds of gravitational lenses. So it's really hard exhausting astrophysical research to do. But astronomers were so keen on trying to find where this exotic matter is. I mean, it's kind of like the holy grail of astronomy right now is to find the location of this exotic dark matter. And now they have found it. And however, I don't think there's a Nobel Prize in this, because it was hundreds of the astronomers and physicists that are involved in this research. And I know the Nobel Prize Committee doesn't like to give out, one prize to hundreds of people. Yes. Yeah, you can't do it with just one lens. I mean, you need lots of gravitational lenses so you can get a profile of what the exotic matter is. I mean, this discovery that there's this gigantic donut around our galaxy and another gigantic donut around the Andromeda galaxy, it took several years worth of gravitational lens studies and hundreds of gravitational lenses to actually map out where this donut resided, how much stuff was in the donut. And one of the things astronomers were interested in is the donut homogeneous and uniform in its exotic dark matter. And to a first degree it is, because we're expecting it would be lumpy. It doesn't appear to be lumpy. It appears to be rather homogeneous and uniform.
Does that mean then that the gravitational lensing is all in a certain plane? Because if it's a donut in a plane, and you see gravitational lensing in this dimension more so than in this dimension.
That's true. That's exactly what we're seeing. Because one thought was maybe it's a sphere,
yeah.
But it's not coming out that way. It's coming out to be a donut. So not, it's not a hollowed out sphere. It really is looking more donut shaped. However, now astronomers are interested, are there twists in the donut? So we don't know that much yet. But to a first order of magnitude, it's homogeneous and uniform. And this does explain some of the unusual characteristics of our local group of galaxies that makes life possible, the Milky Way galaxy. One of the things we notice about our local group is that there's only two big galaxies and about two dozen small galaxies, and the galaxies are far apart. Well, given these donuts of exotic dark matter, that's the way it would have to be if you want life to be possible on our Milky Way galaxy. Because you really don't want these donuts severely overlapping. That's going to cause problems of interaction amongst the galaxies. Yes?
If the stuff has mass and therefore gravity, what keeps it from just mixing with ordinary matter? Why isn't dark matter all around us? What keeps it out there on the outside of the galaxy?
Okay, very good question. What keeps the exotic matter where it is? Because when astronomers first began to do their research, their feeling was the location of the exotic matter will match the location of the ordinary matter. And therefore, they first did their experiments with these gravitational lenses looking at the center of our galaxy, because half the mass of our galaxy is near the center of our galaxy. So they thought that was the obvious place to look. The big surprise is that's not where dark matter exists. Exotic dark matter does not exist in the location we expected it to exist. I mean, a year ago, if I were looking at the book of Job 38 and you asked me, where does this exotic dark matter reside? I would have guessed, like the rest of the astronomers, it's going to follow the same pattern of mass that we see with the ordinary matter. That's not the way it's looking. Okay, why? The reason why is because the exotic matter is subject to different force interactions than the ordinary matter is, which means that there are probably really exotic particles, and we're going to have to rethink what makes up this exotic dark matter. One thing we know is that the neutrinos can't make up any more than 10% and could be as little as 1% of the exotic dark matter. And so that missing 90% must have properties that explains why this stuff is in donuts that seem to be far out from the rest of the ordinary mass of the universe. And I'm thinking this is going to be a rich trove of new design evidences for the God of the Bible. Because, you know, actually to make it all work so life is possible in Milky Way galaxy, you do not want the exotic matter following the same pattern as the ordinary matter. That would lead to chaotic interactions. Having it where we find it is just where you want it. But this means that you've got to fine-tune the characteristics of these yet undiscovered exotic mass particles. Axions may be the key to this whole puzzle. And so astronomers are quite excited to push their research efforts to try to pin down the existence of axions and how much axions make up of the mass of the universe. Okay, over here, there was a hand over here I've been ignoring for some time too. Let me get to it. There have been no attempts yet to measure the rotation velocities of this exotic dark matter. That's going to take more measurements. We don't know yet. Maybe. We don't know. I mean, keep in mind it does not interact strongly with ordinary matter. So there's nothing that says it would have to rotate in the same direction of the ordinary matter, but it might. It all depends on the properties of these exotic mass particles. That's why it'd be so fun to find a whole bunch of these axions, and maybe there's other particles too. Astronomers actually see the hint that we're probably looking at least three, if not as many as 24 different exotic mass particles. Because we're seeing that the universe has dark matter particles that we would call cold, as well as warm, as well as hot. Most of it's cold, some of it's warm, a little bit of it's hot. That means you've got to have at least three different kinds of exotic mass particles. There's a question in the back here I've been missing. Yes? No. No neutrinos. Okay, these donuts I'm talking about probably do not contain a lot of neutrinos. We have a pretty good idea where the neutrinos come from. They come from nuclear burning. So the core of the sun, for example, produces copious amounts of neutrinos. And likewise, when a supernova explodes, even greater amounts of neutrinos are produced. And so, you know, for some time now, we've known the location of neutrinos, the source of neutrinos, but these donuts are probably made up of something quite different from neutrinos. So yeah, just going outside and being exposed to the sun will expose you to lots of neutrinos, and you don't have to worry about buildings. This building's not going to stop the neutrinos. The Earth isn't going to stop the neutrinos. I mean, your body's bathed in neutrinos, blasting it from all possible directions, even through your feet. So, might want to think about that next time you walk outside and all the neutrinos that are blasting all the time, but they don't do you a lot of harm. Yes?
What are black holes made of?
What are black holes made of? Okay. A black hole has such intense gravity that when particles stream into it, those particles lose their properties. So, for example, protons and neutrons will be broken down into quarks, and the quarks will get broken down as they go into the maw of a black hole. And so the whole idea of trying to build a particle physics model of what's going on inside black holes is challenging. We don't know all of the fundamental particles that exist. Oh no, it's pulling in exotic matter too. But that's actually part of the design here. Because if the exotic dark matter followed the same location of the ordinary matter, then that means black holes would be sucking in 10 times as much exotic matter as ordinary matter, which would bloat the mass of the black holes and make them much more dangerous. As it is, there's a gigantic black hole in the center of the galaxy, and it poses no threat to us. But if it was 10 times more massive than it is, then it would pose a serious threat. And because this exotic matter is located long ways out from where these black holes are forming, they pose no threat to increasing the mass of the black holes. By the way, if you wait long enough, all the stuff that gets sucked into a black hole will escape. Once the black hole shrinks down to the size of a quantum entity, about 10 to the minus 15 centimeters in diameter, quantum tunneling takes effect, and everything trapped inside the black hole will spew out. And it becomes what Stephen Hawking coined a white hole. And, you know, if a white hole event happens, we're history. Don't want to be around a white hole event happening. Is that clock off?
Yeah, it's way off. I just discovered that.
Okay, I thought I had another 15 minutes with the way that clock was running. So, I'm all right. I'll try to wrap this up. Let you get out of here. Thank you for noting that. I was just watching that clock, and we're going to have to get that fixed. I can see now it's running slower than it should. So, yeah. Right. Okay. Next week I'll talk to you about where most of the dark stuff exists. It's not the exotic matter. It's not the ordinary dark matter. It's what we call dark energy. That's 73% of the total stuff that makes up the universe. Now, the fun thing about this dark energy, now that we know the location of it, the evidence for supernatural design in the components of the universe is shot way up. We've known for some time that the percentages have to be carefully fine-tuned to make life possible. Now that we know the locations, that's giving us a whole new round of evidences for supernatural design. And keep in mind this, the existence of darkness in the universe is where we find our greatest evidence for supernatural design in all of the sciences. Nowhere else will we find more impressive evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design than darkness. Maybe that's why God put it in Job 38, okay? Because this is the stuff that really gives us spectacular evidence. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for being alive in a day of incredible advance in scientific discovery. Lord, it appears we are the most blessed generation of all in terms of what we've been able to discover about you from the record of nature. Father, I pray that you would deliver us from the darkening of our minds, from our natural propensity because of sin to ignore the evidence for you and your attributes that we see in the record of nature. Pull away that veil, Lord. May we work with you so that your Holy Spirit can work within us to see that evidence, acknowledge it, and receive it. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to work with your Holy Spirit as we discuss these kinds of evidences with the people, that they too may be delivered from that veil of darkness and come to recognize. Lord, I want to pray for Alessandro Morbidelli, a man who's so responsible for giving us so much evidence about the solar system. May his eyes be open to recognize that it's your handiwork that made this possible. And Father, I pray you would use him to not only come to faith in Christ, but to bring others to faith in Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.